week of August 13th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 377, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gills.
Ah, you're back in New York, Michael. I hear that you had to visit New York to see a judge, actually.
Judge?
Yeah, weren't you in the judge's chambers just yesterday?
Oh, God almighty. Yes, I came to New York for some theater, went to a movie with some friends, went to the new Whitney Museum downtown where they moved, and also caught some Yankee games. Went to the Boston game last night, and I'll be going to the Mets game tonight.
But the Mets versus the Yankees.
The Mets versus the Yankees, yes.
Now, what did you think of the Whitney Museum? When I was in New York about a year or two ago, went to see their new digs in, I guess it's Tribeca, right?
It's the Village. It's Greenwich Village.
Okay.
I don't think it's not Tribeca. That's far lower.
But you know, everything in New York City, if you ever look at a map of New York City, it all gets mishmashed over there.
Oh, in the Village they do. Yeah, the grid falls apart in the Village. It's very easy to get lost. I hadn't been there to the new space. It was very nice. Some great outdoor balconies, big, huge spaces where you can get a great view of the city. Love seeing some of the permanent exhibit. Had a good time. Went Friday nights when you can pay what you want. It wasn't too crowded when we arrived a little bit later. Had an hour and a half. Highly recommend it. Certainly worth a look. Saw some great stuff I hadn't seen in a long time, including a number of hoppers, and they had Calder up at the top floor. My only caveat is that they've just moved into this new space, and all museums of that size tend to have a lot more in storage than they can ever display.
Right.
But you really feel like you're not seeing much of a permanent exhibit. It just feels like, wow, you know, that's it. Like, you've got so much stuff. There's seven floors. It doesn't feel even remotely big enough for what they've got. You know, you barely see, you know, like 100 pieces.
You know, it's funny because when I went there, I said the same thing too. And I went back and looked at some of the reviews of the place when it first opened only months earlier or a year earlier. And that was the criticism was, hey, the lovely, you know, 500-foot ceilings are great. But and, you know, you have seven floors, but you have like three pieces on each floor. So, you know, given that you own thousands, if not tens of thousands of objects and art pieces, why not actually display them
or find a space where you don't have to keep so much of it out of sight?
Right.
So it's a good trip. I'm having fun, but it hasn't stopped me from being here for Showbiz Sandbox. That can't be said for you.
Yeah. Well, okay. Look, we all might not be here next week. Okay. Given the news lately. So I just thought I'd plan ahead and go see the solar eclipse.
Oh, you are. You're going. Well, I'm going to see the solar eclipse, and I will be. I'll be available too. But you're seeing. Where are you going to see it?
Carbondale, Illinois. The Path of Totality. Yes.
Yes, I'm going to Nashville, Tennessee. My friends have rented a pontoon boat. We're going out on the water, away from town. We've got the glasses, the approved proper glasses. I'm very excited. I've never seen anything. Not a solar. Not a lunar. Not a partial. So it's going to be fun.
You're going to have to look up, by the way, just, you know.
No, not necessarily. You also want to look down. One of the really cool effects I was reading up on is the shadow that comes flying across the surface of the Earth is moving at 1,800 miles an hour. And it really freaks you out because things aren't supposed to move that fast coming at you. So as it crosses the sun, this shadow comes flying at you. And people, even knowing what's going to happen, go on, they still tend to scream and freak a little bit because it's just so unnatural. That's at least what I've been reading. And you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what it's like.
Well, you know, certainly I know that for people who keep horses and have animals, that's also an issue because, you know, if you think that people are going to be kind of freaked out by this, imagine what it's like for an animal.
You're a regular Dr. Doolittle of podcasts. But speaking of podcasts, we've got a show to do. What are we going to talk about this week?
This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll look at one of the biggest moves by an entertainment company in years. During Inside Baseball, Disney is going over the top, turning ESPN and Disney itself into an OTT app to be available around the world. They'll reclaim movies now playing on Netflix, compete with cable companies for subscribers, and generally make waves everywhere you turn in Hollywood. That seemed huge news. And then Netflix fought back. But first, we're going to analyze the summer of hell at the North American box office. Turns out 2017 might only be the second highest grossing year of all time. What a nightmare. Can you tell Michael wrote the teaser here? Can you tell Michael wrote that last one? Anyway, Broadway should be looking forward to the fall, but instead, everyone is talking about the collapse of the musical Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812, which has charges of racism, unprofessionalism, and bad management swirling around it. Plus, it's closing long before the show's $12 million budget was earned back. During our book filter segment, Michael will talk about a book perfect for the late Jack Klugman. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profits, you name it. And the number one movie around the world again for the third week in a row, Wolf Warrior 2. $84 million on the weekend, $690 million worldwide. It's playing in seven territories. Most of its money is being made in the Middle Kingdom. It's the biggest Chinese film of all time in that country and worldwide. It's just a monster. It costs $30 million to make, and it's still going strong. Of course, there will be a Wolf Warrior 3. This is a genuine, genuine phenomenon. And it's sort of waking up Hollywood to say, wow. You know, we've got to deal with this market. No matter how difficult China is, no matter how many hoops you got to jump through, no matter what red tape or what confusing political things might snag your film, you have to be in that market because it's going to be the biggest movie market in the world. And number two is Annabelle Creation, also a big player worldwide, especially for a horror franchise. This is the fourth in the Conjuring universe, if we can use that phrase. That's the big, you know, catchphrase of the year. It grossed $70 million on the weekend. It only costs $15 million to make, so this puppy is already well into profitability. And unusually for a horror film, they're all pretty well reviewed. The Conjuring movies are very well reviewed for horror flicks. The first Annabelle was the only one that really got poor reviews. This one got much better reviews than that. So they're actually doing pretty good quality control as well, as evinced by the fact that they haven't rushed out Conjuring Part 3. They're waiting to get a good script and taking their time. So it's a really low budget, interesting sort of horror franchise, and there's more coming. There's a spinoff called The Nun and another spinoff called The Crooked Man. So, and of course, Conjuring Part 3. Interestingly, most of that money has been made in North America. No, I shouldn't say that. It's in 40 territories. It's made the same amount overseas as it has in the U.S. because it's been a big player worldwide. And it did really big box office in South Korea. You'd think maybe they'd want something to escape their scary, you know, life with North Korea and Trump battling nuclear weapons. But instead, they went to a horror flick.
But isn't that always the case? Like, horror films do well, you know, in other words, they want to be controlled by something they know is not real, you know, scared by something that is kind of fake. And by they, I mean human beings.
There you go. And number three around the world is Dunkirk, another $25 million, $360 million worldwide. And number four, there's a couple more movies coming out in China because this is the summer blackout period, that unofficial time when Chinese government officials don't allow any foreign films to be released at the box office. So here is Guilty of Mind. It's a Chinese suspense thriller about a serial killer targeting college campuses. That opened to $24 million. Right below that is The Adventurers. This is a Hong Kong thriller. Produced and starring Andy Lau, and it grossed $22 million. And this movie, though Andy Lau is the star, was the director who won out here. Stephen Fung married the leading lady, Xu Tixi, during production. So during the film, they had a marriage between the director and the female lead. So that was nice.
But on camera or off?
No. Not. It wasn't part of the film. They just got married. They fell in love and they got married.
I know that was kind of a joke, but yeah, I figured it
out. Well, they might have worked it into the film. Is there any other Hong Kong movie or Chinese movie? Yes. Jumping down to number 13, Legend of the Naga Pearls. This is also kind of interesting. It opened to $13 million. It's a Chinese fantasy. And it is set, it's the first film set in the world of Novoland, to which, of course, you and I say, what the heck is Novoland?
Yeah, I'm not even going to bother trying to figure that out.
Well, it turns out it's a fictional world created, and I'm not sure by who, but it's set It's a world with 3 continents and 9 provinces covering 10,000 years. It's got this elaborate history. Those 10,000 years are divided into 10 eras, all of them about 1,000 years long, and 9 dynasties. And it's peopled with Chinese mythology and history overlapping with this fantasy world and all these different creatures. It was started by someone amidst the Lord of the Rings film craze in the early 2000s. They wanted to give Chinese writers a chance to play in their own mythological world with a big history. And somebody started Novaland. A bunch of writers, I've seen like 5 or 6 have done short stories, novels, plays, all sorts of stuff set in Novoland, building on this mythology. And now we've got the big first feature film coming out of that world. So that's kind of cool and interesting. But if you know who started Novoland, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's our email address. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. And both on Twitter and Facebook, you can send us messages and we do respond.
All right, so jumping back up the list, we're at number 6, and that's War for the Planet of the Apes. Another $20 million. It's at $315 million worldwide. So it's now pretty much doubled its budget, but it hasn't been released in China yet. That comes up in next weekend, I believe. At number 7 is The Emoji Movie, another $20 million as that movie passes the $100 million mark. It's probably going to be fine because it only costs $50 million to make, and it's not done yet. At number 8, Spider-Man Homecoming had a good week. It passed 2 big milestones. It made $18 million. It passed the $300 million mark in North America. And probably today or tomorrow, it's going to pass the $400 million mark worldwide. So that movie is at $700 million and counting, a very strong launch for that new rebooting of Spider-Man. At number 9 is Despicable Me 3, another $18 million. I'm not sure if it has any big territories left, but it's at $920 million worldwide. So it's going to get awfully close to that $1 billion mark. No surprise to anyone, but The Dark Tower fell hard in its second weekend in 36 territories around the world. It grossed $15 million, and it's at $53 million and counting. I know they signed everyone up. I know they're trying to find some buyer to take up this series. They're going to do 10 or 12 episodes and see what happens next. Do you think they're going to do it?
What, you mean actually have another movie and have a television?
No. It's the TV series is next. They've got all the actors signed up from the movie, not Matthew McConaughey, but they've got the actors signed up and they're looking to find a streaming service that wants to have a 10 episode run of a season of The Dark Tower to begin this long series. Does that make any sense for anyone right now?
Well, it does if you are looking for content for your streaming service, possibly.
Well, everyone is, but do you want to pay money for something that doesn't seem like it's going to be very good critically or commercially?
I think it depends if there is a built-in audience, but a core audience here. I mean, if you look at, I don't know, Supergirl, for instance, you'd think that show was off the air or isn't doing very well, and yet it's got a diehard following.
Well, this is Stephen King, obviously, and he's got 6 or 7 volumes in the Dark Tower series, so we know Stephen King has a following. Has there ever been a good TV series from TV? I don't think there's ever been a TV series, certainly not a successful one based on a Stephen King novel or short story, not that I can think of. He hasn't really been, he's had many series, of course, but I don't think he's ever been a player in the long-form series because he has horror films and there's usually an apocalyptic ending, I guess.
Right.
That's interesting.
I mean, I personally wouldn't necessarily walk down that path.
I would not be eager to jump into that. I mean, they've got a showrunner from The Walking Dead. They've got a big fan base that wants it done right. But since these people just messed up the movie, what's going to make you think they're going to do it right on TV?
What about Under the Dome? No, was that not considered? I guess.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, you're right. That was a successful series launched from a Stephen King novel. Well done. At number 11 is A Taxi Driver, the Korean drama. $15 million on the weekend, $46 million worldwide. Number 12, Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets, $14 million on the weekend. It passed the $100 million mark. It's in 29 territories, so it's got a lot of ways to go, but it's going to need some country somewhere to just go crazy for Valerian in order to make up its loss in North America. At number 14 is Midnight Runners. This is a Korean action comedy about 2 police cadets who try to solve a crime when the authorities are stymied. They sort of stumbled on the crime, you know, turn it over to the appropriate people. And then when those people couldn't figure it out, they said, let's do it on our own. It grossed $11 million on the weekend, and it stars rising talent Seo Joon Park, who first appeared in music videos, then broke through on TV, including his big hit series, She Was Pretty. To which I say, kettle pot, Mr. Park. But anyway, at number 15 is Atomic Blonde, $9 million on the weekend, $60 million worldwide. That should triple its budget and be fine. But it's certainly not the out-of-the-box success that Baby Driver and Girls Trip are. Both those movies have passed the $100 million mark. Girls Trip is at $105 million. Baby Driver is at $160 million. And they both cost, just like Atomic Blonde, about $30 million to make. So those are three mid-budget movies, the sort of thing Hollywood said, oh, we don't like these anymore, they're too difficult, all of which are original. I guess Atomic Blonde is based on a comic book, but Girls Trip and Baby Driver are original, and they've all clicked with audiences. All right, jumping on down, there's a few other new movies that I wanted to mention. First is, where is it? Nutjob 2 opened pretty poorly in North America, $9 million on the weekend. Nobody had high expectations for that. I messed up. War for the Planet of the Apes does not, as far as I know, have an official release date in China yet. I don't think it's open there, but I don't think they have an official release date yet. Cars 3, however, that movie also needs a lot of love. It's at the $300 million mark worldwide, so that's a good, you want to pass that. But it's played out in a lot of territories. It opens in China on August 25th. I confused that release date with War for the Planet of the Apes. So Cars 3 is the movie that gets to open in China. They had a big lawsuit against this Chinese animation company that, you know, did a copycat movie. And in fact, they won in Chinese court. That company wasn't allowed to do a sequel and had to pay reparations. So, you know, hopefully there's some sort of audience for Cars 3 because that may be redemption for them. And then jumping down, here's the last movie I wanted to talk about. It's a Mexican comedy. It's called Hazlo Como Hombre, or Do It Like a Man. And it grossed $2.8 million on the weekend. I think it opened on Wednesday because it's at $3.3 million so far. It's a comedy about a dude freaking out that his best friend is gay. Oh, my God. Can you imagine that? The tagline is, his best friend came out and he'll do anything to put him back in again.
Well, you know what? That's I think there's some double entendres going on there.
You may be right. Two straight stars from the movie who are a couple, a woman and a man, made headlines when they said they'd be fine if they had a gay kid. I mean, that's, you know, that made headlines in Mexico that they said they wouldn't be horrified if they had a gay child. The director is Nicolas Lopez, who has been a big collaborator with Eli Roth, praised by Quentin Tarantino. And this movie, he had the biggest hit in Chile's history, or one of their biggest hits. And now this movie has had the biggest Thursday night opening in Mexican history. So this movie looks like it's going to steamroll into a big, big hit comedy. It could cross over in North America. It looked light and broad. I'm thinking it'll do well here. It'll be fun to see how it plays in the U.S. But that's definitely a movie and a director to keep an eye on. One movie I couldn't keep an eye on is Toilet. This is the Bollywood movie, which another film opened a week early because it was worried about competing with it. I know it earned more than $1.3 million, which is the bottom of the charts here on a ComScore, but there's no word about this flick. In the U.S., it grossed $700,000, a pretty good opening.
That's huge. And I know a very good opening for a Bollywood film.
Exactly. And so it had a good per screen average. So I think it slipped through the cracks, as Bollywood films sometimes do. So we'll have to keep an eye on it. Next weekend, it'll probably pop up with an even bigger gross, you know, total because we missed this week's. But, you know, that's a movie we definitely want to keep an eye on.
So now, maybe, do you think it might be because it's titled something else in India?
No, it's titled that. And it's Toilet and then colon and then something, you know, that is the title.
Okay.
Yeah, so we didn't miss it. So that's a hit for India. Wolf Warrior is a hit for China. And the box office hasn't had a lot of hits in North America.
No, that's everybody's, you know, the sky is falling, according to Hollywood.
I have a couple of points to make. You know, they're calling it the summer of hell. Is it, you know, we've had exhibitors for a long time say, for the love of God, you have to program movies year round.
Right.
And now Hollywood is doing that. We had the biggest spring ever. So obviously, if you had moved Beauty and the Beast and Logan and Fate of Furious into summer, they would have made a ton of money. And then people would complain, you've got two movies opening up in summer and you're squeezing out the box office and these other movies flopped because they didn't have any room. So is it time to sort of worry less about summer? You want to make money, you know, all the time. But if you have $1 billion hit, it's $1 billion hit. Who cares if it's March or July?
Well, I think you always want to care about summer in the Northern Hemisphere. And here's why. Well, and even in the Southern Hemisphere, but we're talking now about the Northern Hemisphere, because kids are off from school. So you want to release certain movies when people are traveling, when they're on vacation, when they have time to go see them. In this case, I think what is happening, and this is just my 5-second take, I think that the studios have been releasing Transformers 9 and Planet of the Apes 200. I mean, all of these movies people are just tired of.
Well, that's the other argument, that there's too many sequels and all these flops are terrible. It's simply not true. Beauty and the Beast is all the big hits. Beauty and the Beast is a live action remake. Fate of the Furious, Despicable Me 3, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Spider-Man Homecoming, Logan, Kong Skull Island, which is profitable, Wolf Warriors 2. These are all movies that are franchises and sequels and reboots. I'm not even including Wonder Woman, which is hardly an original film.
Well, okay, so you mentioned a lot of movies that did well, okay, and did well for a reason. Wonder Woman.
But that's okay. My point.
It's part of a universe, but it's not a sequel. Despicable Me 3, okay, that is a sequel without a doubt. Atomic Blonde, not a sequel. And I'm just going from this week. War of the Planet of the Apes actually got fairly decent reviews, yet did it do well?
It might get back to profitability, but no, it didn't do well.
What about Transformers, whatever we're up to now?
That is not a flop. That has tripled its $220 million budget, but it's certainly not a movie anyone is excited by, nor did it equal the previous movies. But that's not a movie they're losing money on. You can't make $700+ million worldwide and claim the movie is a flop and hurt you at the box office. It's tripled its massive budget. I don't say it's a good movie, but it's made money. But again, that's the whole point. You're holding up Wonder Woman as an example of originality. I'm sorry. Pretty much every movie on these lists is not original. The hits, the flops, and the movies that fall in the middle. So I don't think you can say the problem is too many reboots. And there have been successes that the big studio flops, in fact, you'll find more original movies. Monster Trucks cost $125 million. The Great Wall.
I would not hold that up as a success, though.
I'm saying these are the flops. You're saying sequels make too many sequels. The big flops are Monster Trucks, The Great Wall, Valerian, and then you have some that are reboots. Like
what about Alien Covenant?
Alien Covenant, Ghost in the Shell, King Arthur, The Mummy, Cars 3.
Pirates of the Caribbean?
Did not lose money. Again, just like Transformers, these are not movies that are good, but they're not losing money. They're not making what they should or what they hoped for. They got lucky. But again, that's not a flop. So yeah, they're like, oh, it's too many sequels, except for all the sequels that were hits. It's hard to find a big sequel that wasn't a remake, a reboot, or an existing property. That's what movies are these days. So I just don't think you can point to sequels and say, that's the problem. That's the problem, except for all the hits like Beauty and the Beast, Fate of the Furious, Logan, Despicable Me 3, Guardians of the Galaxy, and on and on and on. Those are all the big hits of the year. They're all reboots and remakes and sequels.
Yeah, I guess I'm not looking at, like, for instance, Blade Runner will say, oh, that's a sequel. Yeah, when your sequels are, 35 years apart, I think you're really just that's not a sequel so much as a new film that kind of covers the same ground, and you may have a different audience entirely. So,
When you're talking about summertime and you want to reach kids, that's a scheduling issue. That is not if summer is down and winter and spring are high, we're going to be angry. I mean, if you want January, February, March to be big, that means some of that box office is going to move from summer. You can't have, magic every minute of every day. If you've got big movies and you want them to space them out, that means there's going to be hit billion-dollar movies released in February and March and January. Okay? Do you want that? Yes.
So, well, and the reality is this. They made The Mummy. Universal made The Mummy. And it could have been good. It wasn't, okay? It just was not good. I mean, like, they made The X-Men. It could have been bad. It wasn't. Instead, it spawned a universe of, and now I granted that it was based on a comic book, but still, it still could have been bad, and it still could have been something that where you had maybe one, maybe two movies out of it. Instead, they got, how many movies have they gotten up to now? 10? And I don't mean just X-Men movies. I mean Wolverine movies and X-Men Reborn movies. And I mean, there's all these because the first movie was good. In this case, The Mummy with Tom Cruise, the first movie is bad. Okay, they may not get as many movies out of that franchise as they had hoped.
Yes, we always want them to make good movies. That has nothing to do with the point I made about 12-month year box office. There are big movies that open in the spring. bitching about they should have had more big movies in the summer. The fact is, the predictions are that this year will gross more than $11 billion. That will make it the second highest grossing box office year in North America of all time. We know you have to look movie by movie to see, you know, if you spend $3 billion and gross 11, you're not doing, or 10 or 9, you're not doing great. You know, it depends each individual movie. What did it cost to make? How much did it gross? But if you're grossing $11 billion and it's the second highest gross of all time, yeah, you want to see what ticket sales are like, but that's probably a pretty good place to start, right? You're feeling pretty good if you're the second highest grossing year of all time. So they're screaming yet again that the sky is falling because they're the second highest grossing year of all time. They're screaming yet again, oh, too many sequels, when all their hits are sequels. That's my point.
Yeah, I guess I look at even like the stock market, even when it's going up, okay, it doesn't go up every single day.
Right. And it hasn't stopped foreign companies from wanting to play a game in Hollywood. The Chinese government is saying, let's not do where you're just an open bank and they take a bunch of your money and make their movies. They want the companies to stay more focused on picking individual films to partner on. Say, I want to make this movie. I want to make that movie. They want them to be savvier and not just open their vaults and say, take all our cash and let us know if we made any money. And yet, Chinese companies were doing that, and they're still looking at Hollywood to pick up some properties, aren't they?
Yes, well, and they're really what China is doing. First off, they're taking one specific person, Wang Jianlin and Wanda, and saying, hey, stop investing outside of China. Okay, so they're really focused on specific people and specific companies leveraging themselves with Chinese money to buy properties outside of China, which could not only bring down the banking sector, but helps remove currency from the country. So that is true.
Well, they were worried also about you know, money laundering.
Well, that's,
you know, it's
yeah.
like people in Russia and Europe who spend, you know, $100 million on an apartment in New York or Hong Kong so they can get their money out of whatever country they're in and then cash out later.
Correct. Well, in this case, everybody thought, well, is Chinese money drying up? And there still is that question. However, Tang Media Partners, which was founded in 2015 by, I guess, Donald Tang is the founder, and he is a former Bear Stearns Asia head. He is starting his own media company. And last year, he bought IM Global, which is a big foreign sales group. And what that means is they take films and they sell them around the world. Sometimes they're made, sometimes they're just scripts with actors and directors attached. But they're
like Valerian. Like Valerian.
That's a great example. But TMP, as it's known, it has ties to China. One of its big backers is Tencent Holdings, which, you know, owns WeChat, the big Chinese kind of Twitter, if you will, or Snapchat. And now they have purchased Open Road Films, Open Road Entertainment. This is the company that was founded by AMC and Regal, two movie theater chains here in the U.S., who said, no, we're not really going to sell our tiny little production company that, by the way, made Spotlight, which won the Best Picture a couple years ago.
And Nightcrawler, which was quite a good film, and The Gray. So they've had some good success stories.
They've also had some really difficult success stories. This week, in fact, The Nut Job 2.
That's not a success story. That's more of a flop.
Oh, did I say success stories? They've had some. Yeah.
So you said a difficult success story, which is an interesting phrase.
Yes, it's been not a success story, is what I meant to say. So the Nut Job, not a success story.
Okay, so Tang TMP bought Open Road. What have they purchased? Because Open Road had access to all these theaters because it was owned by exhibitors. And I know that the creative head has stayed on for a while.
Tom Wartenberg, who actually used to run Lionsgate. Ironically, TMP has also tapped Rob Friedman, who used to run Lionsgate, to head up TMP. Tom Wartenberg will be overseeing Open Road.
So are those basically the people they're buying? Because they don't have a library to speak of, and they don't have, I assume, a ton of unbelievably lucrative franchises in the works. So essentially, they're purchasing the skills of these two men to create new properties?
And the pipeline. So they're buying the whatever library they happen to have.
But okay. That's very modest. It's a brand new company.
Yeah. So whatever library they have, they've made, let's say, 20 movies over the past 5 years, you know, maybe 20, 30 movies. And
That's not a library.
I mean, think about it. When Miramax was sold, they were talking about 700 titles. Okay. Yeah. So there's the difference. Okay. Now, mind you, Miramax had, you know, 2-3 decades on them. So... So they're buying the pipeline and the ability. They're buying the know-how and the inroads, as you say, Michael, to AMC, to Regal, to the American market.
Well, but they're not buying that anymore because they don't own it.
They don't own it. However, they do have marketing ties, much the way, by the way, some of these studios, Sony included, have marketing ties to Wanda Cinemas in China. It's the same concept.
What do you mean marketing ties? What?
Meaning that they will, that's the question that everybody asks about, you know, in China. Like, what do marketing ties mean? Are you actually paying for a piece of the film? Or are you paying up front to help market the film?
I'm saying here in North America, talk about that, because you can't know China. So explain to me what you mean by AMC having marketing ties to Open Road. Now that it no longer owns it, what obligation or what are they going to do for Open Road? Why would they care?
Well, I think in part, and I do wonder about this, and I should actually investigate this further. This sounds like a perfect piece for CJ, for Celluloid Junkie. I should actually say, hey, when you say you have marketing ties, please tell me what that means. Is it co-op advertising, where you take out ads on websites and take out, you know, billboards in cities where the film is going to play? Are you buying ads on television and radio, or is Open Road still doing that? What does marketing ties mean? Exactly.
Yeah, and is it like a financial agreement where they have a piece of the film or the company, and then in return they provide these marketing ties? Or yeah, find out what's going on there. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also a way for AMC and Regal to say, no, we're not totally giving up, you know, any relationship with Open Road. We're still tied to them somehow. We'll play their trailers. Because really, they did say, both of those circuits said, we are not going to sell Open Road. Yes, it's been a long slog. Yes, it's been very difficult to make money as a content creator, but we're not going to sell at all. Okay, we're selling. And the second everything turned difficult in the exhibition space this summer specifically, they sold Open Road.
Well, that's something to figure out. And I wish we could also figure out what was going on with The Great Comet on Broadway.
Well, you know what? This is this story. I have to say, Michael was wrong, people, okay? And I love to say those words. And to be more accurate, by the way, Michael, you didn't have full access to the accounting books of the producers who mounted the Broadway musical The Great Comet, which is what we're talking about here. Looking at the weekly grosses, which is really all the info you, Michael, had, or most journalists have access to, the show seemed to be weathering the loss of its star Josh Groban pretty well, and we talked about that in the past couple of episodes. Groban helped bring in an average of about $1.2 million a week to the show, and since his departure, the musical had made above $900,000, surely enough to keep it in the black week to week. Running costs for a big show, after all, are usually around $700,000, and since this show no longer had big name stars demanding a big paycheck, it should have been fine. But then, let's face it, we talked about this, I think it was last week, all hell broke loose with Mandy Patinkin, as I now know how to pronounce it, Mandy Patinkin, he stepped into a major role. People shouted racism because apparently he was pushing aside an actor of color from Hamilton before that actor's run was done. Then others accused that actor, the actor from Hamilton, of being unprepared for the job. And now the show is shutting down fast because no-name actors want to go within a mile of that show.
Yeah, so, it all comes down to the advance. And they are claiming, the producers, that once they saw Josh Groban leaving the show, that 2-3 months out, nobody was buying tickets. Nobody. So the weekly grosses were strong. They were fine. If they'd stayed there, they would have been good. But they looked into the future, something we can't do. We don't know what the advance is month to month. And they saw nobody was buying this show. I don't know why that would be. It ran for many months, had a good spot on the Tonys. It seemed to be, you know, the 9 weeks that Oak, this actor, his nickname of the actor from Hamilton, that he was going to be in the show, it was doing just fine, staying above the weekly nut, you know, it was doing good. So why, he's certainly not a draw, you know, he's not a name star that's going to sell tickets. He's a guy from Hamilton that most people have not heard. He was the fifth or sixth person from Hamilton. In some of the stories, they talked about, oh, his big fan base. And I'm like, come on, he's the sixth guy you talked about in Hamilton. He is not a big star. So his show was doing fine, but they claimed, oh, no, the advances were collapsing. The show was going to have to close. We need Mandy Patinkin in there just to keep us alive for a few weeks.
Well, you know my feeling about how they should have played this. I mean, we talked about that in, I think it was last week's episode or the week before that, so 375 or 376. Mm-hmm. And it was, hey, I want to go see this show. And you know why, Michael. This is the only theater where you can see this show, which has gotten good reviews, okay? It's the only theater where you can see it as it was meant to be seen, because they retrofitted this theater and turned it inside out, almost literally, to put this show on.
Yeah, that's by far the most notable thing about the show is the space it's in. It's been in a tent. It's been in a sort of an old rundown warehouse restaurant type space. It's all about the actors swirling around you and coming around, and you've got tables and you drink vodka and all that sort of stuff.
Well, so wait a second. Does the audience get to drink vodka?
Some do, and you can certainly buy all the vodka you want and drink it at your table, and they give out some free blintzes every once in a while, especially if you're in one of the really expensive seats on and around the stage.
I'm liking this show more and more.
Yeah, so this show is a mess, and I have to blame the producers. We've now heard the backlash of people saying that Oak was unprepared. He didn't know his lines, even though he had 4 months to get ready. He couldn't play his instrument. He fought with the director. They had screaming matches in front of everyone. And though it's all off the record, there's been enough performers coming forward saying, yeah, he wasn't prepared. You know, so there's been that backlash that he wasn't professional. They had to delay his opening a week, even though he had 4 months to prepare. So that was bad. And then all this blew up in their face, and Mandy Patinkin and all that. But one thing we know is that there was nobody set up after Oak left. You know, they wanted to throw in Mandy Patinkin for 3 weeks. That was just towards the end of his run. And like, well, maybe Oak will come back, even though he didn't like them, had a terrible time, and felt he didn't even trust them when they said, we want you to come back after Mandy. So that's where that bad blood created problems. But who was the person that was supposed to do the show? Why was Oak only signed for 9 weeks, A? And if you could only have him for 2 months, why sign him? But you need a star, or you need somebody. Who's going to be in it next? There's not a word, not a peep. It sounds like they just really dropped the ball and didn't know what they were doing. I mean, they messed the show up when it began by having a petty fight over the credits to the company that originated the show. That created problems with recording the cast album and a benefit performance and really bad blood when the show began. And it's because of new producers, new to Broadway, who don't know what they're doing. They started off on bad ill will, and they're ending on ill will. And whatever went on with Oak, whatever went on with anything else, I blame them. Speaking of Hamilton, I was kind of shocked to see the prices for tickets in L.A.
Well, yeah, because everybody knows that when you park your car on the street, okay, even if your name is Hamilton, you get a big parking ticket, and they could be like upwards of $60, $70.
Yes. Anyway, I'm talking about the musical Hamilton in L.A., top ticket price,
$700. Nobody talks about Hamilton tickets in L.A. because nobody can get them.
But $750 for a top ticket price. The average price people are paying is, I think it's up to $500 now. That's just ridiculous. I know a
number of people who were lucky enough to get tickets, okay? And these are people that don't go to a lot of theater, okay? But their kids got the album, love the album, and are singing the album all
They're
the
like,
time.
I want to go.
Right, and it's coming to, and then they went to get tickets, okay? And they are so embarrassed at how much these tickets cost. And they got them through the box office. They didn't get them through the secondary market.
No, this is face value we're talking.
Right. And yes, there's the $750 top ticket price. There might be, you know, 2-3 rows of that. Okay, but most of the tickets, you're right, even though it's not $750, is in the $300 range. Okay.
No, but yeah, the average ticket price is $500 from the theater. Not second run or buying from scalpers. People are paying an average of $500 to see like the third or fourth company do this show in LA. Trust me, it's not worth it. I'm sorry, but that's just, you have to walk away. That's absurd.
Funny. A lot of the people I know who have tickets now are saying the exact same thing. They're like, you know what? I paid $400. Or they're not telling you, but you know they paid over $300. And they're thinking, is this worth it? Should I just try and sell these for face value?
I mean, I'm sure they'll be happy if they see the show, but I mean, I don't know this particular cast. I'm just saying in general, that's too much money to pay for Broadway. That's just, I know it's live theater, it's big cast. That's just unconscionable. You know, that's opera prices.
Yeah, and opera, they do 10 performances and then that's it. Yeah. And it's usually with, you know, a renowned singer.
This isn't even like Lin-Manuel Miranda. That's right. If it was the original cast in LA, I would say, oh, that's obscene, but dear God, you want to see this show. But we're talking the third or fourth production company of this. That's just, it's very upsetting because you want people to go to the theater. You want them to see these shows, and the show, obviously they can get it because it's it's a once in a decade phenomenon as far as that level of intense desire, you know, the Book of Mormon, the producers, Hamilton, A Chorus Line, you know, it doesn't happen a lot. but it still makes me a little uneasy.
But here's what they did with the Book of Mormon and the producers. So let's talk about that for a second. And I know some of our listeners outside of maybe North America are saying, why do we have to listen to this? But the reality is Book of Mormon and the producers both made it to London. They all made it to Sydney, Australia.
All over the world, over the world.
These are shows that will travel. Hamilton will definitely be in London. Here's the thing. With those two shows, Book of Mormon and the producers, they brought them to Los Angeles and then they stayed here for like months at a time. So rather than try and milk $500 out of every single ticket, they basically said, we'll give everybody a chance to see this. Who wants to see it? Okay. And they got some stars. They got Martin Short and...
They're doing sit-downs in Chicago and elsewhere, and the ticket prices are still through the roof. It's not because it's a short run. It's they're just not doing a sit-down in LA for whatever reason. It's not a choice between sitting there and getting a long run and therefore charging less. That's not the way they think about it. It's like if they can sit there and stay there a long time and they think that's the most profitable thing for them to do, they will. But that's not why the ticket prices are so high.
What I think is happening here is you've got a company, Pantages Theater is where it's at in Los Angeles. They have a whole season every season. You know, they have like 5-6 shows and trying to milk it. They are trying.
No. Every company in the world does that. If you have it as part of your season and it tours the country, they say if you want first access to these tickets, you got to buy a season subscription. That's what has been happening since time began. Again, that's nothing new. That's okay. They've got 5 shows. They want you to. You want the one that's the big hit. Guess what? You'll get easy access if you buy a subscription to all 5 shows. That's okay.
Right. What I'm saying is
to do with the ticket price.
Forgetting that, putting that aside, the company that runs those 5 things knows that, okay, they'll get 50% subscribers and the other 50% buying tickets, we want to milk. They're not going to buy the entire season. We want to milk that.
No, they're going to sell out their season just from people who wanted tickets to Hamilton. Trust me.
I don't know if they did
nothing
that.
It's got nothing to do. Everybody does that with a hot show. It's packaged with other shows. They want to have a good season. They want to lure in subscribers and get you into the habit of going. This has nothing to do with Hamilton and the top ticket price. A sit down or a touring production, a show that's part of a subscription series, or a show you can buy individually, none of that justifies or explains why they're charging $750. They're just doing it because they can and the market will bear that, but it's bad for the business long term.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
And that's why, hold on a second. Get me Bruce Springsteen on the phone.
We're not there yet.
Yeah. And by the way, if you're wondering why I just mentioned Bruce Springsteen's name, stay tuned.
They've heard already. So that was a bad blood on Great Comet. I'm a little upset about the Hamilton ticket prices. And we had another bad little controversy in San Francisco. Stephen Adley Gerges is a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright, and he has a play called The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, which is particularly controversial. It's like a 3-hour play, and this little theater company in San Francisco put it on and they cut it down to 80 minutes.
Well, maybe they looked at their audience and said, look, a lot of our audience members are in their 70s, in their 80s, and they need to go to the bathroom. So let's just, whip things along here. Everybody knows how it ends, okay?
That's against the law. It's against federal law. You can't do it. You're not allowed to do it with your contract to get the play. It's also against federal law. You're not allowed to just cut a play and do whatever you want with it. Not a new play, not a play where the author is still alive. But you know what? He looked at it and he's like, it's a small little company. It's so hard for them to even survive. They insisted, no, we didn't do it for artistic reasons. Like we, thought the play was bad. We just couldn't afford to do it with the full cast. And so this is how we did it. And he's like, all right, just put a notice in your playbill saying you've done this, you've broken the law, you did it without permission, and I'll let you finish the run. So they took that, they put the notice in the bill, and then they tried to have fun with it and tell the world, oh, look, we're controversial and we went against his desires and tried to make hay out of the fact that they were breaking the law and thumbing their nose at Stephen Adley Gerges, who was nice enough not to close them down. And when that came out, he was like, all right, that's it. I tried to be nice. I tried to be a mensch and say, just finish the run. But, you can't do that and you shouldn't do that. And you guys tried to mock me out and make hay out of it. Well, don't be proud that you broke the law and screwed me over and messed with my play. So never mind. Shut it down. So I felt like he was a mensch. He's a good guy. Somehow I'm linked to him on Facebook. I don't know. So that was very cool to see. And one more bit of theater news.
What?
Jersey Boys. Remember that? Ran for 11 years on Broadway. It just closed in January. It's coming back.
But people just couldn't get it. Well, I guess maybe they thought, it was a good thing. We probably shouldn't have closed it.
It's toured all over the world. It's made a lot of money, and they're bringing it back to off-Broadway. They're going to have four fewer cast members, obviously a smaller theater, and lower ticket prices. This is a pretty big trend. Avenue Q, The 39 Steps, Rent. Rent and Avenue Q, I believe, are currently playing. Is Rent playing off? I think they're both currently off Broadway. Million Dollar Quartet, that was a Broadway show about Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison and such. All that played off Broadway after being on Broadway. So this is a trend, a show where they feel like they can repurpose it, get away with a smaller cast, and still sell tickets. You know, because the show was still making some money, but they've crunched the numbers. I wish shows could just stay off Broadway to begin with and make money. That seems to be really hard to do. But somehow, if you play Broadway and then return to off Broadway, you can get away with enough of a ticket price that it's cheaper than Broadway, but enough that you can make your dollar. So it's an interesting trend. I hate to see off Broadway become just a warehouse for old Broadway shows that are almost at the end of their run. But, you know, it keeps the actors working.
That's true. For me, out of all the stories we talked about, at least the theater stories we talked about today, I really would love to know what's going on behind the scenes with The Great Comet. And I'm sure at some point somebody will write about it, and maybe they'll turn it into.
Is that what you said last time?
About The Great Comet?
I thought, yeah, was that your segue last time? I forget.
It's my segue every week of somebody will write a book about it. And when they do, it might get selected on Book Filter. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And every week, you and your team over there at Book Filter, Michael, you pick all the books that we should be paying attention to. But every week, you bring a few books over to us here at Showbiz Sandbox that we should be paying attention to, either here in the industry or maybe producers and studios and networks should be paying attention to them as possible, you know, material for adaptation. So what have you got for us this week?
This week I have a new book. It's called The Education of a Coroner. It's a nonfiction book, and it answers the question, isn't it time for a new TV series like Quincy?
Oh, remember Coroner. Quincy? I thought you said The Education of a Coroner, as in not a rounded shape, but a corner.
You are not a line. You are not a square. You are a corner.
Right, exactly. No,
this is The Education of a Coroner, like the medical examiner played by Jack Klugman on a big hit series from the 1970s called Quincy, M.E. This is an interesting book. It's about the four-decade career of Ken Holmes, who was the coroner of Marin County, California, kind of a fascinating county because it's really affluent, but there's also a lot of drug addiction and problems. It's also the home to San Quentin Prison. There's also famous people. So this guy has been involved in everything from high-profile deaths to serial killers to suicides off the Golden Gate Bridge. Interesting book by an interesting writer looking at this guy and his life, and it just made me think, you know what? That sounds like a series.
That actually does sound like a series, and it's Marin County.
I'll tell Mandy Patinkin that the next time I speak to him.
Well, by the way, tell his twin brother Mandy Patinkin as well.
I'll tell him as well. But he lives in Marin County.
Yeah. but the reason I kind of correct the pronunciation is that a lot of people know Marin County, and that's because that's where George Lucas's Skywalker Ranch is. It's where he lives. It's known as a very upper crust area of California, north of San Francisco, kind of a little bit west of wine country. It's now becoming wine country itself because, let's face it, they're running out of...
The weather is changing.
well, and there's only so much wine, you know, grapes you can plant in the Napa Valley. It's a very upper crust area. So it should be kind of an interesting... That I actually might read that book because, I'd be interested to know just what the coroner in Marin County is doing.
Well, there you go. In Marin County.
Yes.
Well, it's a big deal that I finally learned how to pronounce that.
Oh, well, since you think that's a big deal, then maybe you think some of the stories on this week's Big Deal or Big Whoop are a big deal. How many times can I say big deal in a sentence? Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, speaking of Bruce Springsteen and Broadway, Bruce Springsteen is coming to Broadway, and now... it's official. The famously hardworking showman will do just 5 shows a week. No matinees for the boss, by the way. The entire 8-week run this fall will total just 40,000 tickets, so it should sell out in a heartbeat. How will they fight scalpers? They're partnering with Ticketmaster on a verified fan program. You sign up with a Ticketmaster account to be verified, and you're a verified fan not only for this show, but you can be a verified fan for other artists as well. Then, if you're lucky, a random drawing sends you a code saying you can try and buy tickets when they go on sale. Now, it doesn't guarantee you tickets. You can just try. How this eliminates a bot creating 10 million fake accounts, we're not so sure, but at least they're trying. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. At least they're trying. It seems like what they do is when they get your profile, they do an automatic search to make sure you weren't created a week ago, to show you have some history and thus seem like a real person. And then they'll give you access to the lottery. But it's not like they limit you that much. So it's not, you know, I think you're still gonna be competing with a million people, but at least you're competing with real people and not bots. At least that's what they're trying. I hope after that they say you gotta bring your credit card and your ID to the box office, because that would eliminate, you know, scalpers in general. But it's at least a step forward. At least they're trying. So I appreciate that.
Well, here's the thing.
And yes, I have signed up for it because A, you got to do it anyway for Harry Potter when that comes in February or March or sometime next year. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Bruce Springsteen. I have to say, I was sort of thinking, I beg your pardon for interrupting. I was sort of thinking, oh, you know, I can't believe it. 20 years of covering theater and now I'm going to be out of town when Bruce comes to Broadway. Not that I necessarily would have gotten a ticket anyway since I didn't get Bette Midler. But I've heard from people, he has really been working on this show a long time. He did a version of it at the White House with the Obama family as a little concert. He's really crafting it. He's really working hard. And the people around it say it's just great. It's a career retrospective. He pulls stories from the books. It's just him on a stage, you know, guitar, piano, whatever. But it's just Bruce alone telling his life story from his book, from his life, performing songs. And so instead of seeing him, the smallest space I've ever seen him is Madison Square Garden. And instead of being there, you're going to have 907 people in a room, quiet, not going, Bruce, listening as he performs his songs. I just, you know, I'm really going to be sorry if I miss this.
Well, I can tell you, I've seen Bruce Springsteen at the Pantages Theater, where Hamilton is showing here in Los Angeles, and the Wiltern, which is a little bit smaller. And yeah, it is something special. It was just him with a guitar and a harmonica. I don't even think there was a piano for the
Pantages. But sadly, that was like Devil and Dust tour, or which tour was that?
First it was the Ghost of Tom Joad at the Wiltern, and then it was the Devil and Dust tour, yes.
The problem is that those are bad albums with songs that aren't very melodic. And it's like, I really would love to have seen those tours, but I'm glad this won't be focusing on an album that I don't, one of his few really bad albums. So,
well, I mean, I think he was touring supporting those albums, but
he was,
he also did songs. Yeah, exactly.
But nonetheless, you're getting five or six songs from the Ghost of Tom Joad. It's like, you know, couldn't you give us a little bit of a melody? You know,
well, here's the thing. So, 50,000 people fit in MetLife Stadium, which Springsteen sold out three times over the past year. So that's like 150,000 tickets. There are 40,000 tickets going on sale for this particular Springsteen on Broadway.
Right, 8 weeks, five shows a week, about 1,000 shows a performance. Hey, this hardworking guy, he can't do eight shows a week like all the other Broadway folk.
Well, what I love is that preview performances begin on October 3rd. I'm like, what? He hasn't like had an entire lifetime to do, you know, fixes to this show.
He's crafting a show with light. I'm sure they're going to film it too. I mean, unless there's something insane going on, there must be a deal perhaps from Netflix to tape this. For as all I know, Netflix just made a deal to tape the show. I'm sure it's going to be properly recorded somehow, but no, he's crafting a show. He's not just standing up there doing a concert. He's really trying to find the right pacing, the right stories, the right pace and tempo and what goes here and there. He really is really, really been working on this for a long time. So this is not just, hey, me and a guitar saying, let me sing another song. You know, he's really putting a lot of thought into it and creating a real show. And I'm really excited to see it.
Well, this verified fan technology, kind of, you have to register. I did, just like you did, Michael. And then it kind of goes through your Ticketmaster history and says, okay, have you ever even bought tickets for a performance by this artist before? If not, then you're probably not a fan. And then it goes to Facebook and it kind of looks at, okay, have you posted about this artist before? Because if not, maybe you're not a fan. What I would say is I have purchased tickets both through Ticketmaster and from friends who wound up having extra ticket. You know, so in other words, yes.
I'm sure you'll qualify. I'm sure they won't say you have to have purchased, you know, because, you know, well, I'm sure you'll be all right. They'll see you're an active theater goer, concert goer. You'll be all right.
But he's one of my favorites on Ticketmaster, on my Ticketmaster account.
Well, there you go. You did that and you did it years ago. So I think that'll help too. I'm sure you will qualify.
What won't help is that the average ticket price will be like $700. That's not going to help.
Bruce won't do that. He's not been bad about that, so we'll have to see. I'm sure they will be expensive, especially on the secondary market, but we'll have to see what he does for that. He's clearly not about the money, or he wouldn't be doing just five shows a week in a 900-seat theater. He's doing it because he wants to.
No, but you know what? The last person who, one of the last people who tried out his show at the White House with the Obamas, you know who that was?
No, I don't.
Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Well, he didn't try out his show, but yes, he did the Hamilton mixtape. You're quite right. Good point.
Yes.
Good callback. Keep going.
Okay. Streaming, that is streaming music, is starting to pay off, or at least bring the record business back to some good news. Warner Music Group announced $917 million in revenue for the third quarter of the fiscal year. And yes, streaming revenue was a big part of that. It's their biggest third quarter in at least, get this, Michael, 15 years. Total digital revenue was up 30% over 1 year earlier, hitting almost $500 million and accounting for 54% of all sales. These figures include both recorded music and music publishing. Remember, Warner Music Group is not part of Warner Brothers anymore. They have been solo since 2003 and were acquired by Access Industries in 2011. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, right? Up is good if you're music publishing in the music industry. Streaming is starting to contribute more and more. It's not back to where it should be, but it's certainly good news. It was hard for me to figure out. They just provided like third quarter information going back to 2004. It wasn't clear what the last peak year was or how much it was. So it was hard for me to say, well, was it like 1.7 billion, you know, 20 years ago? What was it? You know, so I'm a little annoyed that I didn't have full access, and I'd like to know the industry as a whole, not just one company. But yes, they're doing better. They're a 15-year high, and streaming is more and more a part of it. That has to be a big deal.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about how when the streaming company, Spotify, Apple, et cetera, reached a certain tipping point that the music industry would start to come back. I think the next stories we begin to hear are artists saying, hey, you guys
still not making any money.
Yeah, you guys are talking about coming back, and you know who's not coming back? Me. I'm still living in my trailer, so can you please pay me?
Yeah, songwriters and artists are still, the record labels might be pulling in the money, but how much is filtering down? Good point.
And you know what the record companies will say? Hey, even when it was recorded music on physical media, you still weren't being paid. We still weren't paying you. So it's the same.
So what's your problem?
Exactly.
Oh, by the way, Wicked became the eighth longest running show in Broadway history this week.
Wicked.
That's happening on this Wednesday, August 16th, 5,759th performance. It's passing Mamma Mia, the eighth longest running show in Broadway history. So soon enough, they're going to make a movie, but they're in no rush.
I'm tempted to say Mamma Mia, but...
there you go. I'm glad you didn't.
But now I did. In any case, HBO was cyber attacked, and just like Sony, their woes did not end the day they found out about it. Hackers have apparently been trying to get a ransom from HBO, doing everything from releasing actual documents from HBO to releasing altered documents to make it appear that they've accessed private emails from HBO's top executives. Now, the hackers are releasing upcoming episodes of HBO shows, including Curb Your Enthusiasm, which doesn't begin airing until October. HBO basically insists they will ignore it all, other than working with law enforcement to find the perpetrators and bring them to justice. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, I think. As we've pointed out before, people have been stealing shows and posting them online and movies and music and books for many years now. So this isn't anything new. We're paying attention to it. They're trying to get money for it. That's a little new. But you know, this hacking and whatever, it's really hard to keep these things secure when they pass between a dozen different companies. You got the editors and the special effects people. There's copies of these shows all over the place. It's hard to keep them secure. They're going to have to do a better job. And I think it's not going to, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm is out already, an episode. I don't think most people will care when it premieres on HBO. It'll be an event, and that's when most people will realize it. And they'll be excited by it. So, you know, it's no fun for HBO, but let's hope it's a big whoop in terms of like, yes, this is an ongoing issue. It's not going to go away. Let's not scream that the sky is falling, because this has been happening for years.
And look at the clientele, okay, for Curb Your Enthusiasm. The audience, if you will, for Curb Your
Enthusiasm. They're not 14-year-olds downloading illegal stuff.
Yeah, I mean, look, I will never forget... Larry David being on my flight home from Show West or CinemaCon several years ago, and he sat right next to me, and he was like trying to put his bag in the overhead compartment on Southwest Airlines. He's like, it's not going in. I can't get it. There's no room in these things. And then he sat right down next to me, and I was like, oh my God, what do I do for like 50 minutes? But and now he's still got this show on. I was like, didn't that show end? But apparently it hasn't. And it's still, people love this show. But
oh, yeah,
they're not downloading it from BitTorrent. I can tell you that. CNN has fired another commentator. This time it's Jeffrey Lord, the conservative mouthpiece for President Trump. He was in an online war of words with Media Matters, an organization he feels attacks free speech by organizing boycotts against on-air personalities like Sean Hannity, their latest target. After a little back and forth calling them fascist, Lord tweeted a mocking Sieg Heil, but CNN said Nazi salutes are kind of indefensible. In announcing his firing, CNN hastened to add that they had about a dozen Republican commentators on tap who tend to support Trump and some other Republicans who tend to be critical. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's tiresome, just as with the probably dozen of Democratic commentators they have who are just sort of mouthpieces for the party. I wish they weren't on their payroll. They wouldn't have to fire him if they weren't paying him. Yes, it makes sense to bring someone on sometimes who has a mouthpiece type perspective, like who's just going to toe the party line, but they shouldn't be on your payroll. Mostly I want to hear from journalists who will tell me the facts. I don't want to hear from people who are just going to knee-jerk tell me what their boss wants them to say, and that includes the people on the left who are in the Democratic political hierarchy. I don't like it. I get sick of it every time I see it, but apparently Anderson Cooper was sick of it too.
Well, actually, that was Justin Peters of Slate, because Anderson Cooper basically said, look, Donald Trump could take a dump on the White House desk and you would defend it, Jeffrey Lord. But Justin Peters said Lord's only qualifications for being on television were his readiness to applaud even Trump's most noxious moments and the fact that he already owned a suit. I thought that was kind of funny. But to me, Jeffrey Lord will forever be remembered as the person on the left side of the split screen during Van Jones' White Lash speech on election night. So if you've seen that speech, you know who Jeffrey Lord is, because they had a split screen and he was responding to Jeffrey Lord and basically saying, look, this is not necessarily, you, congratulations to you since you supported him, but this is not good news for the country as a whole.
Well, he won't be remembered forever, so that's certainly true. And if I got it wrong that it was Anderson Cooper, it might be because that's what you said in the show notes.
That is true.
however, you know, like the commentator for the Guardian or whatever, the newspaper that was fired, and they're like, oh, he had like a string of negative, nasty, hateful comments. You know, Jeffrey Lord said compared Obama to Chairman Mao, because one of his slogans was forward, let's go forward, and Chairman Mao had the great leap forward. So he decided they were akin to each other, a man who killed tens of millions of his own people. He's compared Obama's movement to Hitler Youth. You know, he's demanded the Democrats apologize for things that were done, you know, 180 years ago by the Democrats, who are basically the Republicans now. I mean, he's just a pot stirrer. He's just a, you know, so why have him on as a regular paid commentator of CNN? Who they might have on is Bill O'Reilly, because he's got his website. You have to subscribe to be part of it. He started streaming video in a daily thing. He's got a new book coming out in September called Killing Britain. And there's a tentative schedule for him to make an appearance on CNN promoting that book. And that'll be one of his first big appearances on TV since he was fired from Fox News. Stranger things have happened than bringing Bill into the mix on CNN.
SoundCloud just got a new infusion of cash and a new boss, by the way. The streaming service has been a mainstay for DIY artists, DJs, and tiny record labels looking to make direct connections with industry folks and fans. Now it has received $170 million from an investment group, and they're going to try and segue into a paid streaming service a la the big guns, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and the like. Two Vimeo top dogs are in charge now, including Kerry Trainor as CEO and Michael Weissman as Chief Operating Officer. Does this mean all those folks who love SoundCloud will be more encouraged to pay for the premium version? I don't know. Big deal or big whoop?
I don't know. I feel like it might be a big whoop. I mean, they've got two new people in charge. They got some money. Is it enough money? What's their plan? I don't know what they're doing different or why you would invest in it. SoundCloud is cool. People love it. We want it to survive, but making this transition is not working for them. They just fired 40% of their staff. They closed two offices, getting some money thrown at them and hiring two new people. Well, okay, but what are they going to do? So until I know what their plans are and what they're going to do with this $170 million, it's hard for me to know whether they've got an action thing that they can do or whether they're just going to fritter away that money on desperately trying to do something that can't be done.
Yeah, I don't know. They should have been acquired. That would have been the the best deal for them.
To be like an adjunct to Spotify or something like that?
Correct.
Or Apple?
Correct. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Last year, author N.K. Jemisin became the first black person to win a Hugo for best novel. Now, she's won it twice. The first win came against the backdrop of block voting by a group of mostly white, mostly male fans who felt awards had been hijacked by political correctness and wanted to see some old-school sci-fi win. Not this literary stuff written by people of color and chicks. It got ugly, with a number of awards not even being handed out due to other fans protesting this takeover of the Hugos to make a political protest. So then Jemisin won for a novel that had indeed been widely praised by critics, featured a big-boned, dreadlocked woman of color as its protagonist, and featured nary a reference to the usual tropes of space opera. Now, with her award for The Obelisk Gate, Jemisin has done it again, proving her first win was no politically correct fluke, but a recognition of a major talent. She's the first person to win back-to-back Hugos for best novel in 25 years. The last one to accomplish this feat? Also a woman. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Most of the awards were won by women. This has been happening for a few years now. There's a lot of exciting talent in sci-fi and fantasy among female writers who have probably been more predominant in fantasy, have always been sort of shunted to the side. There's always exceptions. But Lois McMaster-Bujold was the one who had won back in 1991-92. This year, she just won for Best Series. That was a series that she actually began or was developing back in 91 and 92. So it's a really cool era. And now we have Ava DuVernay, the director. She's turning a sci-fi classic into a TV series. It's called Dawn, and it's based on a novel by Octavia Butler, also a female black sci-fi writer who certainly paved the way for N.K. Jemisin and so many others.
You know, Dawn is a good book, but if you really want a good book, try Noon or Sunset.
Okay.
That's my joke, because playing off of Dawn. Oh, never mind.
Keep going.
In any case, CBS honcho Les Moonves, he says, the company expects the OTT offerings of CBS and Showtime to total 4 million viewers by the end of 2017. And that means their further goal of hitting 8 million subscribers by 2020 is looking as easy as pie. Sure, but why would their goal for both CBS and Showtime worldwide be only 8 million in 4 years? Anyway, in case you were wondering, yes, it was a cold-hearted business decision to put the Star Trek Discovery series on CBS All Access instead of Showtime, or selling it to Netflix, or God forbid, on CBS itself, because they believe they can make more money that way. CBS now plans to launch an OTT sports offering, but that's in very, very early stages. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it seemed sort of a big whoop at the time. The numbers sounded small to me. What do I know? I mean, you've got 90 million households in the U.S. and your goal worldwide is only 8 in 5 years or something, or 4 years. That sounded low to me. And I'm still not sure that the Star Trek Discovery on an app is the best thing for the Star Trek franchise.
Well, it's not an app. It's not an app.
Well, it's on an exclusive website streaming service, as opposed to the CBS network or something where a broad group of people can reach it, like Star Trek The Next Generation, which debuted, yes, in syndication, but it was accessible to anyone and everyone and had huge numbers. So I'm not sure that's the best for the franchise itself. So, and given all the other news we have coming up, this feels more and more like a big whoop every second.
Well, a couple things. Why is 8 million by 2020 the figure worldwide? That seems so low. Yes, it is. CBS and Viacom, public companies, they don't want to set the target for like 25 million and then miss it, because of course that then hampers your stock price. So why not set it for something unreasonably low, and that way you can surpass it and say, look, aren't we great?
I'm not impressed by the fact that they're only going to hit 4 million by the end of the year. That seems low to me. That's now they said, well, we're going to hit 4 million. I'm like, is that all?
Well,
so I get what you mean. They want to lower expectations, and that's the game they play. But they're telling me we're going to hit 4 million by the end of the year. That's it.
A lot of people felt they couldn't do that, because why pay for just CBS and Showtime? I mean, most of the people are paying for Showtime. That's what they're paying for. They're not paying for CBS.
CBS All Access gives you both? I thought it were two separate offerings.
Oh, maybe they are.
Yes, they are. There is it's access. It's total numbers for the CBS Access Online, CBS All Access, and Showtime Online, like Showtime To Go. So it's two separate services totaling only 4 million people by the end of 2017.
So I would love to know. I would love to know what the numbers for CBS All Access are.
Well, they've got to be far lower than Showtime because they have nothing original on it really yet.
No. And
they just have the Good Wife spinoff.
And that is why you see them doing this Star Trek Discovery series on CBS All Access. They're trying to have something that will entice people to get one more $5 subscription to add to Netflix or to Hulu or to whatever.
And people are not going to have 20 subscriptions to all these apps or whatever you want to call them. All these cable channels online on their own. They're not going to have 20 of them. I'm not going to spend $5 and have a $100 bill just for these, you know, just to get Showtime and HBO. You know, they're not going to do it.
It's funny you should mention that because I was going to coin the phrase right here on Showbiz Sandbox, subscription fatigue. But apparently people have already coined that phrase already, so I can't. But it does actually bring up what we're going to be discussing during Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And sometimes our stories don't necessarily directly affect our listeners, at least initially. This week, I think it's safe to say that the stories we're going to be talking about will directly impact the way our listeners watch content, whether it's television or sports. All of these streaming services, there's kind of chaos, and when there's chaos, new winners emerge.
Absolutely, and we've already teased at the top of the show, Disney, where people have been waiting for years. When are you going to make the move on ESPN? When are you going to give people the option to get ESPN on its own, just like HBO To Go is there for Warner Brothers? And now they're doing that. They're saying, we're going to have an app for ESPN. We're going to have an app. I keep saying an app. We're going to have a streaming service for ESPN. You don't have to have cable. You don't have anything. If you want to buy ESPN, you can. We're going to have a streaming service branded Disney. That's big cable channels for them, by the way, where they make a ton of money, the Disney Channel, but they're going to have a streaming service for Disney stuff. They're going to pull back a lot of their movies that are already airing on Netflix. When those contracts end up in 2019, they're going to keep them for themselves. That's going to be a streaming service that they provide. They haven't decided yet what to do with Star Wars and the Marvel movies, but a lot of their properties, certainly their family properties, are going to go to Disney, including the animated movies and Pixar.
Well, and that's the thing. That's one of the things that Netflix pointed out as well. They said, look, if you read Disney's statements and what Bob Iger is saying, he says new movies will not be going to Netflix. In other words, Netflix will still have access to Disney movies, some Disney movies.
No, not all Disney movies. But those contracts end in 2019, and then they are taking them back.
Well, they have to renegotiate a new term. By the way, they won't be exclusive anymore, so that means Apple can negotiate terms for some of those older movies. But the reality is, you're talking about library content. When Finding Dory 3 or 4 or 5 comes out, guess what? It's not going to Netflix. It's not going to Apple. It will be on the Disney service.
Right. Yeah, right. So, okay, you just go to Netflix and saying that's not true.
Well, what they're saying that's not true is that Disney films will no longer appear after 2019. What they're saying is they very well may. It won't be new films. In other words, it will be all of the back catalog possible.
But that's what Disney wants for their channel in the first place. Of course, they're not going to give them the back catalog. They want their old stuff to be anyway. Yeah, so that's to be worked out later. But obviously, Disney's going to suck up as many of them as it can.
Right, exactly.
Right. So a couple of things. One, this major moves, people have been waiting for it for years. Finally, that's going to really affect the cable business, isn't it?
Well, that's everybody always asked about, like, well, when is Disney going to make a move on ESPN? When are all of these services like Disney or Discovery Channel or Viacom with MTV, when are they going to go over the top? And the answer has always been, well, we can't do that because we can't upset the MSOs, the cable providers, because they are our distribution right now. That's how we make our money. They pay us.
They're our golden goose.
Right. However, the golden goose is getting a little tarnished because every single quarter, it's offering fewer and fewer subscribers. And we always said, follow the money. When the money starts to decline and you see the market shifting, that is when these moves will be made. Well, of course, you're seeing that. Fewer and fewer people. Now, it's not, you know, 4 million people have cut the cord this quarter. No, it's, you know, 300,000 people one quarter, 400,000 people the next quarter, but eventually it adds up. And what Disney is doing is what they should be doing, which is looking to the future and trying to position themselves and saying, okay, we're going to be earning less from MSOs, so let's take these people back directly and directly connect with them so that we have their credit card information, we have their email addresses, we can market directly to them, and that's smart.
Well, they've been doing a lot of direct marketing. They have a really big fan base and D25 and all these things that they do for their customers who go to their theme parks and such. But one of the things, the people leaving those cable subscribers are often going to a skinny bundle.
That's
and those
right.
skinny bundles almost always include ESPN.
That's right.
So they may be going from one to the other, but is Disney going to be undercutting even that new area where they were still considered one of those channels you had to have, and now that's not happening?
Well, they purchased a majority share of BAM Tech. This was the Major League Baseball streaming service.
Yeah, that's a different issue.
Right, and so I only mention that because there's been discussion about, since nobody knows what this ESPN streaming service is, what they're saying is, well, this will probably be content that is not on the linear channels and not provided in the, and thus not provided
in the skinny.
No, it will
be plus. It will be plus. No, no, no. They have specifically said you will have the access that's on the linear channels, plus we'll have extra stuff. This is the annoying thing. You're a cable subscriber. You pay $120 a month. You get ESPN. Yes, you can access the app, but when they have something on the app that's not on the network, you're going to have to make a micropayment. You're going to have to pay extra to access that. So yeah, you pay all this money a month for ESPN and you go on the app or the streaming service, and you're going to be annoyed that you can't access all the stuff that's on there. You're like, well, I pay already for... No, no, no. You want that Man United game, you're going to have to pay extra for it. It's not going to be, you know, Monday Night Baseball or whatever, but it will be stuff that's not available on the regular service, and they've decided you got to pay extra to access this stuff. And yes, the service they provided for does all the streaming services for Major League Baseball, so they have all the tech for doing that very complicated job of having those hundreds of games available online at the same time to a bunch of different people. And they're going to have, you know, games from all over the world, programming from everywhere. And it's going to be on the streaming service. But just because you're a cable subscriber doesn't mean you'll have access to it.
Right. And BAM Tech also provides some of the streaming technology for HBO for some of their streaming services. So,
yeah, they're clearly the backroom people that you want. Here's what I think is funny. Amidst all this news that people have been waiting about for years, they had their quarterly report, and the best story that they had was theme parks.
Right.
What really bolstered the bottom line was the theme parks, stuff you can't stream, stuff you have to actually show up for. And, you know, this was even before Pandora had gone fully online, and they still have Star Wars to open up in some parks. So they had not done these big, two huge new additions that people are waiting for. At least they hadn't been enough to affect the bottom line. And parks were a really big story for them this year.
And by Pandora, we mean Pandora World, not Pandora the music service.
That's right. You're right. The Pandora Avatar World. Yeah. So that had just opened up in one park, and Star Wars was going to open up, but they increased 18% from the same quarter 1 year earlier. So that was a really big play for them, and they were really happy to tout that.
Well, and the question is, look, Disney can do this. There's no doubt. They have the content.
Yeah.
They have all of the animated content. As you say, they can market directly. They already know where half of their customers are. This is not, it's not hard to see how Disney could do this, both with ESPN and their own content. Could Discovery Channel do this? It's a little bit harder, because you know what? If you've got kids,
no.
you're going to get Disney over Discovery. Are you going to want to pay 20, 30 different subscriptions and suffer subscription fatigue between Netflix and Hulu and Apple and Disney and Discovery? And no, you're not going to want to. So Disney can do this. How many others can? I don't know. What I would say is there are beginning to be certain winners in this space, just like with the internet. You know, when technology causes changes, there's, you know, 1,000 different telephone companies in the early 1900s. And then, of course, it all kind of rolls up into just a few. You know, there's, and of course, with telephones, it was one. Here, you're going to see the same thing. You have Netflix, Hulu, Disney, Apple. You have all of these people trying to find space here and make their way in this space. But ultimately, it's going to wind up with a few of them. My question is are Apple, are Facebook, certainly Twitter, they may be too late.
They may be, but Facebook did just announce a big deal. They've got like 30 different programs coming, or a bunch of programs coming from 30 different suppliers, including some big names. They're looking mostly at really short form stuff. They've got Univision, Major League Baseball, Time, the NBA, A&E. They're looking for stuff that you can do on the go, but they're also going to have live baseball every Friday night on Facebook, presumably for free, I guess. They just want you to come to Facebook. So yeah, they're a player. They're trying to add in. Meanwhile, NBC thought they were early. They're like, oh, we'll have a comedy channel. It'll be great. A streaming service. You'll just pay $5 a month and you'll laugh your ass off. Well, CISO is shutting down. Nobody knew how to pronounce it. Nobody knew what it was. Nobody cared. So yeah, you're right. Just being early isn't the right thing to do. But, you know, why did Disney make this move now? You know, we've been waiting for several years. Were they jumped? Did they jump or were they pushed?
I think a little bit of both. I think they're jumping because they realize, okay, what we see with all of our, you know, MBAs and people in the back room who are really smart is this is our revenue coming from the MVPDs, the MSOs, the cable companies over the next 10 years. And as people begin to cut the cord, it's going to go down, 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 down. We need to cut out the middleman, i.e. Netflix and these cable operators, as soon as possible and go direct. And
well, I say they were pushed because they knew what was going to happen this week, which was the announcement by Netflix of one major blockbuster deal after another. Netflix has signed Shonda Rhimes and stolen her away from Disney. She is
stolen her away.
Yeah, hold on. Oh, stolen her away from it. She's like the major player on ABC television. Netflix also stole away Robert Kirkman, the creator of the Walking Dead comic books, stole him away from AMC. They also stole away Chuck Lorre, who is the mainstay sitcom producer for CBS. He's doing a deal with a sitcom starring Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin. The Coen brothers are making a TV series for Netflix. I mean, the biggest producer for ABC, the biggest producer for CBS, they've got David Letterman doing an interview show, and they've got the name from AMC. All coming to Netflix with their next projects. That to me is unbelievable that they would steal. I mean, Chuck Lorre has been so important to CBS for so many years. What could Netflix have possibly offered him to make him jump away from a 10, 15 year relationship?
I can't believe you didn't say they stole David Letterman away from retirement. Because
they did. Yeah, he's got a six episode, you know, it's an old man gig where he interviews people for as long as possible. I'll speak to this person for 90 minutes, you know, but cool. I want to watch it, but it's not an important thing in particular. It just feels like a nice little addition. Whereas Shonda Rhimes and Chuck Lorre are still major, major players on those two networks. Nobody is more important to those networks than those two people. They have proven again and again they can create hit shows. Netflix must have written checks that would boggle the mind.
Well, and they probably offered guarantees. And I guess I'm going to go back to HBO here. HBO was a service, much like Netflix has been traditionally, of providing content that others had created that was library content, okay? It wasn't original content. Then they started getting into the originals game. They started making original content, and they were successful at it, much like HBO was. Now, they're showing more and more original content, and what is attracting people to Netflix isn't the fact that you can watch all of, you know, Disney's library, but the fact that Stranger Things is on there, Orange is the New Black is on Netflix, and there's a wealth of other original shows that you can only have on Netflix, including, by the way, House of Cards. Now, the reason I mention House of Cards is that when David Fincher and Kevin Spacey were shopping that show around, they went to several different networks and several different premium cable networks, including HBO. And it came down to HBO and to Netflix, literally down to the hour, like they were negotiating overnight. And basically, Netflix said, look, we'll guarantee you two seasons, okay? And we'll just give you $100 million. You go make the two seasons, okay? And then come back to us with the two seasons. That's you know, go make your shows and then come back to us and give them to us. That's what they might be offering these creatives. In other words, we're not going to do these like, well, make four of them. We'll see if they're any good. Then we'll give you another five.
And well, that doesn't happen to Chuck Lorre and Shonda Rhimes. They don't get told, you know, we'll try a pilot.
No. They'll say we'll try a full season.
Yeah. They make major commitments and they have every desire to make them as happy as possible.
And it also might be, you know, some things we're not thinking about, which is backroom dealing with agents, because these agencies get cuts of these projects, especially if they set them up at high values at places like Netflix, at places like Hulu.
Well, there must be big deals when it's at CBS. Shonda Rhimes must get big paydays. There's no way she can't. She's still got multiple new shows. She's got a spinoff from Grey's Anatomy with Fireman. She's got two new shows from proteges of hers that she is linked to, all of which are coming out on ABC. They're not moving to Netflix. So it'll be projects beyond that where she's involved. But again, we got to see what the deal is, because it must just be a check that boggles the mind. I assume they have pretty much all the creative freedom they want, other than the fact that it's on network TV. Is Chuck Lorre so determined to curse? Maybe that's why he wants to be on Netflix. But John Landgraf of FX said it well. We were talking about streaming or subscription fatigue. He said, I don't think the average home is going to have 20 streaming services. I think we're talking about a very, very significant reordering of the structure of television. You know, it's like, yes, this is happening, but most people are not going to pay $5 to $10 a month for 20 services. They can't.
No, what has to happen now that there is competition and a way for viewers and audiences to say, you know what, Spectrum, Time Warner, Comcast, Sky, I'm going to cancel my subscription. And instead, I'm going to go and just get like five of these services for a quarter of the price. The MVPDs, these cable operators and satellite operators, need to come down in price. And that means that the entire television industry is going to have to rethink the way it does business. As John Landgraf says, a reordering of the structure of television.
They'll have to stop charging, you know, $20 a month for renting you a cable box just for the privilege of watching their TV shows.
Or $20 a month just for access to ESPN, for instance. Yeah.
Well, that's not what people pay. They pay $120 and get Wi-Fi plus this and that. But again, they're going to end up where we think most people will end up, which is that cable will end up being the better deal. Because
possibly.
It's not even close to being, even at $120 a month with Wi-Fi, you know, that's still nowhere near you. HBO, Disney, ESPN, you're up to what, $30 a month? You know, come on. It's crazy. You know, you're going to be at $100 in the blink of an eye. You're not going to have 90% of the channels you want. People say, I only want 20 channels. But guess what? Your friend says, oh, I saw the show. It's great. You're going to be annoyed that you can't see it. Or viewership will get so fractured that there won't be any big hits anymore.
Not that we should belabor this point, but more and more what I'm finding is that when I sit down at the television, yeah, sure, there's like one or two channels that I'll watch. But more and more, I'm going, okay, where are, as you say, Michael, where are my apps on my smart TV? Because I want to watch something on HBO, or I want to watch something on Netflix, or want to watch something on Amazon. I'm not actually worried about it, about television.
Except you got to find out where it is. Well, and Glenn Campbell's not worried anymore either. He's a big country pop crossover, and he died this week, died at the age of 81. He was a big session musician before he became a solo star. He played on music by Sinatra, Dean Martin, Elvis Presley, Rick Nelson. He toured and recorded with the Beach Boys. And he was sort of like a guy that seemed cool at the time, sort of, but kind of acceptable to your parents as well. Someone in an obit said that he was the sort of guy that would smile at you and seem really nice and then wink at you as well. You know, wink at your mother when you weren't paying attention. And he, of course, covered a wide range of songwriters, you know, Southern Nights and Rhinestone Cowboy, and had a great late career resurgence, a couple really good albums toward the end, probably the best albums of his career, even as he began to battle the Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, it was nice that at the end of his life, he got to see people give him the accolades and attention that you know, he deserved.
Yeah, there was just an interview, I don't know whether it was on NPR or Fresh Air, or where people that had played with him and were still communicating with him were talking about, you know, the stage he was at with Alzheimer's, and that he said, look, when he's singing, you know, he can hum along and he knows some of the words. It's the music that he has stayed in touch with. But, you know, there are good days and bad days.
Yeah. So, yeah, those final tours were kind of special. I mean, when he would start to repeat a story he just told a minute ago, some family or friend who was on stage would, you know, let him know to move on. You know, like, it was just kind of lovely that they were all there to support and make that stuff happen. And Barbara Cook is a lovely story as well. One of the great Broadway singers and cabaret stars of all time. She died at 89. Big star in The Music Man. It doesn't get much bigger of a hit than that. And Candide, Carousel, Follies, The King and I, all those were revivals except for Candide and The Music Man. But her career crashed and burned because she was a dreadful alcoholic and suffered from depression. And then she had a comeback as a cabaret star, arguably the greatest, certainly one of the greatest of all time. A great performer. I saw her do a Sondheim show at Lincoln Center that was just one of my favorite shows of all time. It was just sublime.
And
a lovely story about the end of her life, isn't it?
Well, yes. As she was ill for quite some time, And so all of these Broadway stars started coming to her New York apartment, bringing guitars and singing, and Hugh Jackman coming along, and Audra McDonald and Josh Groban all showing up just to sing with her. And even though she couldn't necessarily sing the way she used to, or even sing at all.
She would blink her eyes or squeeze a hand, or sometimes touch her lips, showing she was aware of what they were doing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you might think, well, why are they talking about Barbara Cook? We don't know who Barbara Cook is. And I was one of those people. Okay. I said, who is this Barbara Cook, and why is everybody making such a big deal out of her? Then I heard some of her music and went, oh, I totally know these. You totally know Barbara Cook's music. You just don't know you know. Because she had two careers, as you mentioned, Michael, one on Broadway and one as a cabaret singer. And I would be willing to bet most people know her from her cabaret days.
Well, she never had any hit songs, so I'm not sure about that. Certainly theater people do. She only had two original musicals, The Music Man and Candide, that people remember that well. A lot of her hits were shows that she didn't originate. She sang songs that were part of the Great American Songbook from Carousel and Follies, but she didn't originate Follies. She was in the great one-night concert production of Follies, and she was just tremendous. She did a wonderful, very brief revival of The King and I with Farley Granger, another performer I interviewed before he died. I interviewed Barbara Cook once. It wasn't a particularly special interview, but I was just glad to get to chat with her for a few minutes. But a tremendous performer in cabaret. Unless you came to New York and saw her in cabaret, or you're a big cabaret fan and bought her albums, you haven't heard her music on the radio. It's certainly not true.
Oh, no. And in movies is usually, where they kind of would.
No. She doesn't get, her songs don't get used in film or whatever now.
As background music? I could have sworn I heard some of those songs in movies.
You've heard those songs. They're just not originated by her, and they probably weren't the recordings of her. She just sang the great songs that, have become standards, and just a late breaking story. But, it's lovely, and I hope you check out some of her albums. Certainly, if you can see some of her great, tributes to Sondheim, that's great. But some sad news at the last minute here. A stunt person on the set of Deadpool 2 died in a motorcycle accident. A female stunt performer died. They're investigating it right now. It doesn't happen a lot on film, and so it's always really sad when they do. Tom Cruise got injured a week or two ago. I'm not sure how hard, or just a few days ago, I should say, but he slammed into a wall and he limped away, so he was not, critically injured as far as we know, but hopefully he's doing okay as well. But yeah, a person has died making Deadpool 2. Very sad situation. We'll find out more along with everybody else.
Well, we hope you stay with us to find out more about the entertainment industry, maybe not next week, but the week after. If you really don't want to miss an episode, there's a really good way to do that. Subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can find our show. And we do encourage you to subscribe to our show in any one of those podcast aggregators, rate and review the show in them. It does help us out when you do that. Let other potential listeners know how great the show is. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as those ways to subscribe to us, all of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can look us up on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up, and we do respond to messages when they are sent to us, either on Twitter or Facebook. Again, all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
It's novoland.com.
I have no idea what that means.
It's a callback to the Chinese, alternate universe that they created. I don't know who did it or where, but I figured I might as well get on the bandwagon.
I wish I could make a joke about that because that would probably make me smart. Instead, I have no idea what it is. And I will tell you, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you should always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until 2 weeks from now, play nice.
wish you could make a joke about anything.
Oh!